A new national study out this week shows Springfield, Bloomington, and Charleston's poorest residents are dying at a younger age than the rest of the state.
The study, at its essential core, shows that because there's this geographic disparity in life expectancy, there can't be a one-size-fits-all sort of band-aid or fix.
We'll look at what's going on. Later, we're in the middle of the 18th annual Ebert Fest in Champaign. We speak with the women behind the festival film Radical Grace, which tells the stories of the nuns on the bus.
I did not become a nun thinking it was going to make me holier than anybody else. I mean, I just thought I was going to be able to do stuff that meant something.
That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's probably not a surprise to learn that people who have lots of money live longer than people who don't. But a new study out this week from the Journal of the American Medical Association adds that not only to that adds to that evidence, not only that, but it gives us some new insights to the understanding of life expectancy. That's because the data shows that if you're poor, where you live can have an impact on how long you live. Here in Illinois, the data shows that lowest income people in the greater Chicago area live longer than their counterparts in Springfield, Bloomington, and Charleston. And I should clarify who we're talking about. This research looks at people at age 40 with an annual household income of $28,000 a year or less. That's the bottom 25% of the income bracket, and they are being compared with people in the top 25%. On the line to talk with us about these findings and what they mean for people here in Illinois is one of the study's co-authors, Ben Scuderi. He's a predoctoral fellow at Harvard University and worked with Stanford economist Raj Chetty on this research. Ben, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Let's start with the big question. Just looking at the data nationally, why are we seeing, what does this data tell us about why we're seeing why lower income people, particularly when we're looking at where they live, why does that matter so much?
Study is just taking kind of the highest resolution picture yet of the relationship between income and life expectancy in the U.S. And what we find is that at the national level, there are just huge differences between how people at the bottom 1% fare and how people in the top 1% fare. So if you look at men, men in the top 1% of the income distribution live about 15 years longer than men at the bottom of the income distribution. So men at the top 1% live longer than men measured in any other kind of country that we can see. So any, you know, average life expectancy for men in any other country. But men in the bottom 1% live about as long as men in Sudan and Pakistan. So they're just kind of living in completely different worlds of health. And for women, that life expectancy gap is about 10 years so versus the 15 for men. So just to benchmark that, the gap you'd expect between smokers and non-smokers in life expectancy is about 10 years. So these are just huge gaps. It's as if everybody, you know, in the bottom 1% is smoking and nobody in the top 1% is smoking.
Yeah, that's a really good way to, I think, explain the data for people. I know we wanted to take a closer look at what's going on in Illinois compared to other parts of the country. And when we looked at the raw data, we found that if you average across the entire state, Illinois actually has one of the smallest disparities in life expectancy between, as you said, the rich and poor, between that bottom and top 1%. But we also thought it would be interesting to take the Chicago area out of the equation and look at the rest of the state. And then that's where we see a huge drop and the difference in life expectancy becomes actually one of the biggest in the country. What do you think is going on in Illinois?
Yeah, so I think it's Illinois is part of a wider regional story in the U.S. because we find that when you just map out the life expectancy numbers for people in the bottom quarter of the income distribution, the places that look the worst kind of on that measure are Indiana and Michigan and Ohio, kind of the Rust Belt down through Texas, kind of in a big swath diagonally across the country. So Illinois is kind of smack dab in that swath. And what we think is driving a lot of that is that we found that the most predictive thing about a place to predict their life expectancy of low-income individuals is just looking at the health behaviors that low-income individuals engage in on average in that place. So by that I just mean you can look and take something called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which is kind of a cool name. So just a great survey that's done that surveys people and asks them what their income is, but also asks, you know, how often do you smoke? How often do you exercise? What's your height and weight so we can calculate your BMI, and among other things. And when you look at that by place, places that, and compare that to our data, places where people self-report that they smoke less and they exercise more and they have lower BMIs, those are the places that are doing really well. And conversely, the places where people aren't engaging in those healthy behaviors are places, on average, that are doing worse. And the Midwest is, that kind of swath through the Midwest down south into Texas is kind of the place where those healthy behaviors all kind of converge in the bad direction. So
I love how you said that. So basically, when you said healthy behaviors converge in a bad direction, what you're essentially saying is the Midwest is the least healthy. And I think what was so surprising when I was looking at this, and this is, you know, the producers and I, we've all been looking at this all week, is that the South, I think traditionally we've tended to think, oh, well, the southern part of the U.S. is where poor people have the hardest time. But actually, when you look at the data, the Midwest is worse than the South.
Yeah, it was very surprising to us when we first were kind of producing our first results on this, using this data, just trying to match it up against what our intuition was. The South looked a lot better than we expected. It's still not, you know, amazing. It's just on average, if you take the South as a region as a whole, for poor individuals, it's a little bit below average for the U.S., but I think most people would think that the South is, you know, doing so poorly on so many measures that they'd be, you know, smack dab the worst. But what it turns out to matter is the fact that we're conditioning on a specific level of income. So if you look just at everybody in a place and you take their average life expectancy, you're going to be mixing up poor people and rich people and everybody in between. And we know from kind of our national statistics that poor individuals just in general, no matter where they are, have lower life expectancy. And it turns out that the reason the South looks so bad in kind of the aggregate measures is because it's just a poorer region. A larger fraction of people there are poor.
So
when you kind of control for how what the shares of poor people, you know, poor and rich and middle-class people are in each area, the difference, you know, disappears because it's mostly being driven by the fact that there are just more poor people. And when you actually look at how poor people are doing there, they're doing about average. And so when you map out kind of, you know, bringing it back to those healthy behaviors, when you look at a map of just smoking rates in each place, it really kind of looks like the areas of the U.S. It's very regional, and the areas in the U.S. that smoking is highly is very popular in, I guess, are places kind of right in the Midwest.
Do people smoke more in the Midwest then compared to other parts of the country? I've always wondered that. Anecdotally, I've always thought that, but I wonder if the data shows that.
Yeah. In fact, one of the places that smokes the most is actually West Virginia, and that's kind of another locus of smoking. And it's really amazing how regional it is and how clustered it is. It's not, often you would think that smoking rates would be more uniformly distributed, but it's actually, you know, across different places because smoking is a fairly common activity. But in actuality, it's much more clustered.
Right, another and not anymore, too, which is interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking...
Sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to reintroduce you for folks who may be just tuning in. We're speaking with Ben Scuderi. He's a predoctoral fellow at Harvard University, and we're talking about this study that was just published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And I wanted to remind everybody, a lot of this data might be, it's a little hard sometimes to take in. So we've created a couple graphics, especially about how we presented this data for Illinois, and we're tweeting them out. So if you follow us at 21st Show, that's 21st Show, you can see that. They're also up on our Facebook page. And if you have questions about this, you can tweet to us, tweet at 21st Show, and maybe Ben can answer them. You can also give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation, too. Joining us by phone from Chicago, Dr. Ram Krishnamurthy. He's an assistant professor at the University of Chicago School of Medicine, and he's also the state director for Doctors of America, which is a nonprofit group of doctors throughout the country working on improving access to high-quality, affordable health care. Dr. Krishnamurthy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
As you're listening to this and as you're hearing Ben talk particularly about healthy habits and exercise, it's sort of the things that we thought, right, in terms of smoking is probably not a surprise to you as well as exercise. I wonder, being a medical doctor in Chicago, what are your thoughts about might explain the difference in life expectancy we see based on geography? We've been talking about the Midwest and the South, but I'm curious particularly your thoughts about Chicago versus the rest of the state.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, and thanks, Ben, and the other study authors for bringing this really important data to exactly what you said, Nyla, which is these are sort of things that we have thought for a long time but haven't had as granular data as the authors have brought for us. You know, in Chicago, I think one of the important points to remember is that there's a really heterogeneous population in Chicago and throughout Illinois. And even in Chicago, we have large swaths of different ethnic groups and different different income groups. And even within communities, we have some heterogeneity in income. So in the South Side, for example, there are definitely areas that are of middle class and there are areas that are very poor. And we encounter that at the University of Chicago in the South Side. We take care of people who are of very, very low income, maybe zero income, and then we take care of people who are middle and upper middle class. And it's very clear that income, wealth, affects people's ability to behave healthfully. Not only that, but to also, it also, what is very, very important is that the communities in which they live, the physical environments in which they live, also affects their ability, their access to healthy behavior. So that's access to healthy foods, grocery stores with fresh produce, that's access to parks and walkable areas, and that's access to public transportation, that which also promotes healthy behavior. And all of these community-level factors and social factors are maybe even more important, well, are definitely more important than their access to medical care, and I think the study also shows that.
And I wanted to, yesterday we spoke with, to bring in sort of the perspective for East Central Illinois, we spoke with a professor at Eastern Illinois University, Michael Gillespie, and he spoke to a little bit of what you were saying, Dr. Krishnamurthy. Let's hear what he had to say about issues of access to not just medical care, but as you said, those healthy practices throughout the state.
In places like the East Central Illinois region, which popped up as one of the lower parts of the state, and in other areas that are predominantly rural, or what we call micropolitan, which is this area that kind of floats between really dense urban areas and really sparse rural areas, which the East Central Illinois region is that there's not a lot of those resources. And that they're very centrally located in some of the larger cities, and people in outlying areas have a hard time getting to them. And so that's going to impact just their access to services.
That's Professor Michael Gillespie at Eastern Illinois University. Dr. Krishnamurthy, and Ben, I want to ask you this too. Let's start with you, Dr. Krishnamurthy. Is it resources that's the issue, or do you think it's access to resources versus what we're talking about to create sort of all of these healthy habits? What do you think
it is? Yeah, that's a great distinction. We talk about resources as if, you know, kind of in the aggregate. But I think the access, take for example, we actually have a very, kind of vibrant park district system in Chicago. I mean, there are many park district facilities where there are gyms available, there are swimming pools, et cetera. But the access to them, of course, requires being able to get transportation to them, to go to them. And especially, during a Chicago winter where it's very difficult to navigate outside. There's also access in neighborhoods that people feel unsafe in. And there's a, there's unfortunately grown over many decades a culture of fear and anxiety and stress. And there's really good data and literature now about how, stress in the neighborhood at almost a community level leads to or is very highly correlated with poor health outcomes.
Mm.
So I think that that's right. I think it's not just sort of resources in the aggregate, but it's, at the individual level and at the community level, the ability to access those resources.
Ben, what did you all find in the study?
Yeah, well, just to quickly underscore that point, I was going to also just note that I think stress is a big factor in mediating some of these differences because I think it is really a story about resources and the resources available to each person and to each household. And one of the things that goes into that calculation is that, mental resources are a huge component, and poor individuals have higher levels of stress. And there's a lot of research to show that stress and just being in the state of poverty can reduce your ability and to think and have mental resources freely available to devote to other things. So when you're thinking about spending time in the day and using part of your day to exercise or controlling whether or not you're going to smoke today or controlling what you eat, having those mental resources available is just really, really important, I think, as we all know.
Yeah.
And then what we found in the study was very interesting, and it confirms a lot of kind of previous research, which is that when you look at low-income life expectancy among low-income individuals, it's actually not positively or strongly correlated with measures of access to healthcare, which is very, kind of counterintuitive. And one thing that we wanted to stress about that...
Ben, I'm going to stop you there because it's a big point and we're going to take a break, but I want to come back to it after the break. We're talking to Ben Kaskaderi and Dr. Ram Krishnamurthy about life expectancy and income. Stay tuned. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a few minutes. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering knowledge in its disciplines by recruiting and retaining library faculty, researchers, and thought leaders with deep subject matter knowledge and expert librarianship. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about new research that looks at income and life expectancy and how this plays out in certain parts of Illinois versus others. We're talking about what factors might be driving these differences. And one thing I think that's probably become pretty clear in our discussion so far is there's lots of different factors that play into life expectancy. Earlier, we spoke with Eastern Illinois University sociology professor Michael Gillespie, and he had this to say about the complexity of the situation.
I think that if you're going to look at practical policy types of issues is that there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all. And I think that the study at its essential core shows that because there's this geographic disparity in life expectancy, there can't be a one-size-fits-all sort of band-aid or fix or whatever you want to call it for the disparity. You really got to look at what's happening within these regions that are impacting these life expectancies.
My guests with me on the line are Ben Kaskaderi. He's a predoctoral fellow at Harvard University who co-authored this study, along with Dr. Ram Krishnamurthy, who's joining us from Chicago, where he teaches and practices at the University of Chicago. He also works with Doctors for America. Ben, I wanted to get to the point you were making just before the break, because I think it is a significant one, because we were talking about how it's not just access to care. You were bringing up issues of mental health. I wonder if we could get into that a little bit more. Maybe moving it away from whether it's access to even, I think people think about this as an issue of being access to just health care, but that's not what either of you are saying. You're talking about lots of other factors that are involved here, right, Ben?
Yeah. I think our study shows, at least from an association standpoint, it's impossible for us at this point of the research phase to say that anything is for sure causing people to live longer in certain areas, but we certainly find that at least in the raw kind of associations, access to healthcare is not as important, or doesn't come out as important of a factor as just the health underlying health behaviors and some other factors that the median home value in your city, which just kind of summarizes some of the economic conditions in your city, seems to matter more just from an association standpoint than access to health care. The percent of your city that's college graduates is more strongly associated. The local government expenditures per capita are more strongly associated. So there's some environmental factors about where you're living and the characteristics of that place that are more important.
Right. Dr. Krishnamurthy, I wonder if you could react to that as well, because you are tackling this from not just an access to care issue, but as a medical doctor. And when you hear all of that, what do you want people to think about when they're looking at this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to take the opportunity to highlight here is the idea that health behavior is complex. There's a risk. There's a tendency, I think, to talk about sort of colloquial words like personal responsibility and culture, among groups of people who are in the poor. But we have to recognize that, health behavior is complex and is influenced by many different factors, not just these sorts of willpower type, easy answers that a lot of people talk about. When people are stressed about being able to make ends meet, put food on the table, get child care for their children, or decide on child care or getting a job, those sorts of factors are much more immediate concerns than the long-term health investments of healthy behaviors. And we're talking about long-term health investments. And so I want to just highlight that, instead of sort of talking about the personal responsibilities about health, we have to recognize all of the responsibilities that individuals have. The second thing that I'd like to point out among access to healthcare is that right now our healthcare system really financially just heavily skews medical care. And that's medical care for acute conditions, but also diagnosable chronic conditions. And as Ben was saying before, access to behavioral health or financially supporting behavioral health even other types of non-physician, non-medical care, such as health coaching, health psychology, the access to that sort of...
What do you mean by health guidance? Psychology?
Yeah. So just as I was saying, the complexity of what influences people's behaviors and then what gets ingrained in people's lives.
Okay. So habits and how we form habits as well.
Exactly. The formed habits. Okay. Exactly. And how do we switch those habits? Now, it's not simply done by individuals who may not even be aware of all those factors, but it can be guided by behavioral health providers and health psychologists and by ingraining that sort of provider psychology as well at the healthcare institutions. I think we've made some strides in trying to drive towards changing our payment for the value instead of the volume of medical care services. But we still have a long way to go, and that's I think that can have a lot of influence on people who continue to engage in poor health behaviors.
Ben, I wanted to ask you about one thing that Dr. Krishnamurthy brought up, which is he was sort of talking about how we tend to kind of focus on personal responsibility. And to kind of build on that and think about maybe more even corporate responsibility or social factors, I wanted to ask you about some interesting things that came out about social isolation and life expectancy. And I'm thinking particularly in rural areas. How much do you think social isolation plays a role in life expectancy when we're talking about people on the lowest end of the income spectrum?
Well, certainly. I think it's a complex picture. So one of the things we did was looked at income segregation just within each place, and we wanted to see how strongly that was associated with life expectancy. And we found, a not very strong correlation there. And what you'd think when you look at income segregation is if the poor and rich subpopulations of an area are living in very different places and are more isolated from each other, you would usually expect that to mean that poor individuals are doing worse. And what we find is that they really aren't in those cities, which is kind of a strange finding that we can't explain. But I think the other point you made about rural versus urban areas is very strong in this data. So, you know, low-income people live much longer in areas that are urban, and I think that has a lot to do with this underlying story of a lot of this, which is health behaviors, and the fact that in New York City, where people from the bottom of the income distribution live the longest, they walk everywhere, which is just a very mechanical thing.
Right.
There are lots of mechanical things.
Same thing involved. In Chicago, sure. Yeah,
in Chicago, people walk everywhere. But, you know, it's hard for us to explain exactly what's going on with the rural versus urban differences besides those kind of mechanical things. But I think certainly there's potential for a large portion of that to be explained by the isolation of these rural areas.
Mm, that's interesting. All right.
Yeah.
Well, that can be your next form of research, right, Ben?
Yeah, exactly.
That's going to be the next study. Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap up this conversation, but I appreciate the insights both of you have brought. Ben Scuderi is a predoctoral fellow at Harvard University, co-author of this study about life expectancy disparities. I want to thank also Dr. Ram Krishnamurthy from the University of Chicago, where he teaches and also works with Doctors for America. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new exhibit opens today at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. It's called Unfinished Work and contains more than 70 pieces, not just from the former president, but from his family, including Grandpa Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln's grandson. James Cornelius is the curator of the exhibit and of the entire Lincoln collection and joins us now from Springfield. James, welcome to The 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you taught me a new phrase when you and I were speaking about this exhibit yesterday, which is Lincolniana. Can you explain to everyone what that is?
That means all the stuff around and about and concerning Lincoln, in the way that the word Americana is all that stuff of collectibles, I guess.
And do different presidents have different names then for this?
Well, most would have a name if they're collectible, though you don't hear a lot of them sometimes. Jeffersoniana and Washingtoniana are collecting fields. I know that already we have one for our current president, but I'm not sure what the term is because his last name is harder to work into that.
Obama would be hard. I think you could come up with this, James.
It might be Barackiana.
Okay. So let's go back to the Lincolniana, and there are 70 pieces in this new exhibit. Is there a common thread or story that you feel like they're sharing about President Lincoln?
I guess you could say the common thread is that his life was integrated in surprising ways across the six sections of the exhibit. It's about his family, his friends, his early career, his wife, of course, his presidency, sadly, his assassination. And there are overlapping items and themes in there. Turns out there's a lot of science, which surprised me once we got this all in place. There's a lot of science. Well, his grandfather, whom you just mentioned, was a pioneer in Kentucky after he'd been an officer in the American Revolution. And we have on loan as part of this show that Grandpa Abraham's pocket compass and sundial. It's smaller than a business card. It's an incredible piece of early scientific machinery, I guess. And then the future president goes on and becomes a surveyor himself as a young man here in central Illinois. His grandson, Abraham Lincoln II, called Jack, who died as a teenager in 1890, sadly, had a big reading habit, and one of his favorite topics was the railroads, young boys aspiring to be engineers on the railroad, for example. So we think of Lincoln as a wordsmith and a great speaker and a leader of other people, but he's got a mind that is attached to the scientific development of his life that kind of comes all through his family.
Yeah, there's also, I saw when we were, I was looking through pharmacy scales as part of the exhibit. What are those?
They're not very pretty, but they were necessary. They are made of iron, and the concept of a scale goes way, way back, of course. But you have, in this case, four different weights. There's a half-pound weight, a one-pound, a five-pound, a 10-pound. And at the family pharmacy, three blocks from the Lincoln's home, they would go in and buy starch or cough candy or cream of tartar for joint pain.
There's also good for baking.
Yes. Well, not probably
not
a
this
pound
one.
At a time.
Okay, right.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you do big baking.
What's your favorite piece on display with this, James?
Oh, I've got a couple of famous. Sorry, I got a couple of favorite pieces. One, from the historian's point of view, is a scrapbook that ran for 50 years, which was kept by Mary Lincoln's cousin, a young lady, and then an older lady in Lexington, Kentucky.
And was scrapbooking a thing back then?
Not that big a thing. No, that's partly the unusualness of it, but it's just such a great little insider snapshot of Lexington social life. All we're able to display here in the case with the scrapbook are three or four of the pieces out of it, but it's got her programs from musical events she went to, theater, photos of friends and family back in that day when there were little boys dressed in dresses and curls in the 1880s and 90s. There's a gem of a photo from that. This is kind of what Mary Lincoln might have collected herself had she been a scrapbook.
Oh, interesting. Now, James, yeah. I know that anybody can actually sponsor some of these artifacts mm-hmm. that you guys have, right? How much does it cost? What's the typical going rate if you wanted to sponsor a piece in this unfinished work exhibition?
These pieces almost all come from the Taper Collection, which our foundation acquired a few years ago. And this was our chance to put out about 70 items that supporters of the foundation have underwritten or sponsored. So, yes, you ask, can more be underwritten? And the answer is yes, of course. They go from the kind of the mid to high three figures, $600 or $800 for some things, on up to tens of thousands of dollars. Typically in here, these items were sponsored in the range of something like $2,000 to $8,000 might be an average. So these are people and families and, in a few cases, companies who don't have a lot of money, but some of them have more than others, and some have very little. But they're people who love Lincoln, and they're helping us keep these things here in Illinois for a long time. It's a great, intensive, and personal look at this wider circle of Lincoln's life and all the connections of it.
James, I bet a lot of people listening must be wondering about the state budget situation with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. How does that work for you guys? You do get some state funding, correct?
Yes, we are not part of the federal system that the National Archives oversees, running from Herbert Hoover's presidency on up to now Barack Obama's Library and Museum that'll be in Chicago someday soon. We are entirely supported by the state of Illinois at the level of the employees here. And then our foundation that we just talked about is a private organization that takes in memberships and helps our cultural and educational programming. So we don't get any federal funding at all, and that is a problem right now. As you say, the state's budget is not healthy, and we don't know what will happen next.
Are you getting state funding right now?
The employees are being paid all through the state, even though there is not a budget. But we can't buy books for the library right now. We can't buy paper clips. We are using 10 years of older things. We're reusing some things.
Okay.
We're not exactly starving. We're lucky to have jobs.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you for
it. Yeah.
Thanks for that, James Cornelius, curator of the Lincoln Collection. Unfinished Work runs from today through May 15th at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. James, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. Bye-bye.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I did not become a nun thinking it was going to make me holier than anybody else. I mean, I just thought I was going to be able to do stuff that meant something.
What did Jesus intend when he called only men to be his apostles? A patriarchal system.
They're hypocrites. They believe over there on that side about abortion. We don't believe in killing babies, period.
These nuns are worse than pedophile priests because they don't have any way of the future of our children and grandchildren is at risk.
Those are a few clips from the documentary film Radical Grace. It tells the story of nuns on the bus in a particular period when these American nuns were being investigated by the Vatican. It's part of the 18th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival, Ebert Fest. So the director of the film, Rebecca Parrish, is in studio with us, along with producer Nicole Bernardi-Race. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, before we even get into the whole story, what was the motivation for you to tell the story of, in Radical Grace, you focus in particular on three specific sisters?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was very interested in how social justice work could be approached as a spiritual practice. And a good friend of mine had worked with a group of nuns to start a school for people who are formerly incarcerated. And so through her, I learned about the sisters. Before working on this project, my image of a nun was totally shaped by Hollywood. Sister Act, Blues Brothers, things like that. So this really opened my eyes.
And when we think about that, I think for people who maybe have that image, maybe the Hollywood image of nuns, and for people who aren't familiar with nuns and their role in the Catholic Church, how would you describe what you think being a sister in the Catholic Church, being a modern-day nun, is all about?
I'd say it's about living a calling to act for social justice. So for them, it would be the idea of walking your prayer, of helping to embody the love of God in our world today, wherever there's need, regardless of people's faith or, you know, what they've done in life, right or wrong, just being there for people and loving people and trying to create equality and justice.
That's Rebecca Parrish. She's the founder of Interchange Productions and the director of Radical Grace Film. Producer Nicole Bernardi-Race is in studio with us as well. Nicole, how did you decide to focus on these three women in particular? And how did you find them?
Well, as Rebecca said, she met the first nun, Sister Jean, through a friend of hers and got to know her and explore her work and realized that there was a much bigger story. It's when the Vatican, the censure came out, right? Mm-hmm. And started just kind of seeing that this was something that was about a whole group of women, more than 59,000 women, American women. And so she started just kind of interviewing people, going lots of phone calls. You talked to hundreds of nuns, right? And yeah. They were all saying a lot of interesting things, but very few would say things on camera. So the people we settled on were people who were very brave in their work, who actually greatly embodied the breadth of what women work, you know, the nuns work on. And I think we found a really great story there because we were able to look at, like, people who are working on the streets, people who are working in, you know, government and social change here in the United States, and then people working on church reform.
And I think that's a really interesting thing because when you look at particularly the women that you focused on, so much of their work is to kind of speak to what you were saying, Rebecca, about social justice. And I wanted to focus on kind of one of the key points of the film, which is their role in the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much you think people are aware of the role that particularly women religious played in helping get that passed.
You know, when Hillary Clinton's emails had to be made public, one of the lines in one of the emails was like, thank the nuns for healthcare reform. Let's go have a drink to the sisters. So, you know, they had a really big impact because when the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops came out in opposition, it was very valuable for legislators, for Catholic legislators, whom there are a lot of, to have a Catholic voice in favor of the law and helping to embody, the fact that from the sisters' view, that this was a fundamentally Catholic value, having access to health care.
Well, and it really also then sets them up, right? Mm-hmm. Because it sets them up against the U.S. Conference of Bishops,
right,
which took a very different position. And I wanted to ask you about the time period that you all have. I'm interested to talk to you later about how much you think maybe that's changed since you all have filmed this. But within that time period, when we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, it was interesting for me to hear you guys say that a lot of the people you interviewed didn't want to take a public stance. They didn't want to be in the film. Do you think that there is a culture of, particularly among women religious, that they may have these personal opinions, but they feel like it's not a place where they can express these very publicly?
I think there are two aspects to it. One is that in order to do the work that they've done for so long with people on the margins, sometimes it's helpful for them to stay under the radar because, people, that's why their politics are also often very different from the clerics, because they've been with people, in the streets, on the margins, and they see what real people's lives are like. It's not like this armchair theology. It's, the theology of the street. What would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I think that's exactly it. And, Pope Francis just came out with this, this was the synod of the family, right? Mm-hmm. And he talked about conscience and the role that conscience plays in being a Catholic. And I think the sisters have a very well-formed conscience that is speaking to them because of their direct experience.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very, maybe that's, now we have Pope Francis who is saying these things very publicly from the highest perch of the Roman Catholic Church. But at this point, and the point that you all focus on in this film, these women religious are actually being investigated by the Vatican. And there's a kind of a open question as to what's going to happen to them. Why do you think they were seen as such a threat?
They were following their conscience and their understanding of the faith, as opposed to what a lot of the male religious leaders wanted to kind of declare from on high. I think they embodied a really different, they're kind of two, if you crystallize it, you could see two different approaches to what religion and faith means. One is about, you got to follow the rules. Some people are closer to God. Some people are further from God. And then the view that's embodied by the sisters is that we're all interconnected. And we're all deserving of love. It's not about the rules, as Sister Simone says in the film. It's about just bringing that light and love into the world.
Mm-hmm. And, as you say that, that's kind of juxtaposed with some of the hostility that these women face. And I wanted to play a little clip of that from the film. We heard part of it at the beginning a few minutes ago, but I wanted to play that full clip of what they face. And in particular, this is when they're at the U.S. Supreme Court, as sort of all of the fights about the Affordable Care Act are happening.
They want to be phony over there and pretend that they're religious. They're hypocrites. They believe over there on that side about abortion. That's killing babies. We don't believe in killing babies, period.
Okay, I'm not
advocating in favor of Bishop Bowen.
Good, so are we. We stand with
really him. Would appreciate it if you could stay out of politics, because there are so many people in your
okay.
city.
I can't do this.
It's really a difficult situation.
Thank you, sir.
These nuns are worse than pedophile priests because they don't have any way of the future of our children and grandchildren is at risk.
That's a part of the film Radical Grace, which is actually going to be featured tomorrow at the Roger Ebert Film Festival at Ebert Fest here in Champaign. And the director, Rebecca Parrish, is in studio with me, along with producer Nicole Bernardi-Race. Was that, and that probably wasn't just at the Supreme Court, right? I feel like I should correct. There was a couple scenes in there. Mm-hmm. As you all were following them around and filming, was that level of hostility, was that an extreme example, or did they get, was that kind of a constant thing that a lot of these women faced?
I think that it was constantly, you know, a lot of the people who showed up to the rallies were really their supporters. But those views that were embodied by those protesters, I think, represent a very particular aspect of the Roman Catholic Church in this country. So it's not that we saw them everywhere every day. I mean, the majority of the experiences were very positive. But those people who did take from the opposition, I guess you could say, who took the energy to show up, represent, I think, mm-hmm. a pretty big group. And you see those people online a lot, actually. Those kind of comments show up on the internet a lot.
Oh, right. Because people are probably more comfortable saying those things online than they are on camera to you. But I think people who hear the story of these women might wonder why they just don't leave the Catholic Church. And I wonder what you learned about them, which compels them to remain a part of the Catholic Church. And even, I think it's interesting, these characters, too, their work to have women in leadership in the Catholic Church in some ways seems almost tangential to they're very primarily concerned with having social justice and reading, having that mission met.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before doing this project, I was raised kind of marginally Episcopalian. So, you know, I don't have a lot of background in a faith community. And I don't consider myself to be, necessarily Christian. So I had to, or definitely not Catholic, just not my background. So I had to learn a lot. And a major thing that I learned was, you know, before this project, I would see religious leaders who were on TV who had the pulpit, and they would espouse like a certain view and rules kind of about their faith. And I thought, okay, well, that's what it is. Either you agree with that or you're not that religion. And what I learned from the sisters and from, you know, a lot of the Catholics that I met in this project is that they don't see the church that way. They don't see the faith that way. They claim their space in their faith. And, you know, it's just as much their religion as that of the people who are in power.
And now you have Pope Francis, who's now saying, he went back this morning and I was to what he said when he was here in the U.S. And he said very specifically, he singled out these women and he said, thank you for your spirit, for the spirit of courage that puts you on the front lines. And he said, I want to say thank you and I want to tell you that I love you very much. And I wonder how much you think that if attitudes have changed since you filmed this and Pope Francis if it really has.
You know, I think that what we're seeing in this, and I actually was raised Catholic. I'm Italian-American. I kind of have to be. And I spent a lot of times with nuns, which is one of the reasons why Rebecca hired me, because I speak their language. And, you know, it really, I stepped away from the Catholic Church for a long time, and I still don't go, even though Sister Chris says her greatest joy will be if she can get me back to church. And that was the church that I grew up in, the church that was about this kind of communal going forth and having courage and going to meet the people on the margins. So I think what we've seen is a leadership shift through Pope Benedict. And now what we're seeing is something that never went away but was not coming forth from leadership through Francis. So it's kind of a tricky question because it's a little bit of both. You know, it's that it's like who has, as you said earlier, the pulpit, who's got the microphone, who's actually broadcasting what the message is. Doesn't mean they're speaking for everybody.
Well, and I wonder, as you all based in Chicago, if you see a change also with the change in leadership in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely. The new bishop is definitely, I think, giving room for some of the more progressive people in the archdiocese to actually have some say and some room to do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, with both Francis or Archbishop Supich in Chicago, you know, they're not, of course, not changing any fundamental doctrine.
Right. We're not going to be seeing women priests anytime soon.
Right. Exactly. No. But the tone is shifted. And there's a more, people would say a more pastoral tone, a tone that's more compassionate and a little bit less shut down and I would say less fear-based.
Mm-hmm. That's Rebecca Parrish. She's the founder of Interchange Productions. She's the director of Radical Grace Film. Thanks to her, as well as to Nicole Bernardi-Race, one of the producers of the film, which is going to be tomorrow afternoon in Champaign, featured at Ebert Fest. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
The 21st is produced by Amanda Hunting Fort, Christine Herman, and Austin Keating. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director, and thanks to Aaron Navarro for his help today, too. Special thanks to the Midwest band Public Access for the music we've been playing on the 21st. Their album is actually called Public Access. You can always reach us by emailing talk@21stshow.org, or you can give us a voicemail if you want and give us a call, 217-300-2121. Visit 21stshow.org for all of our contact information. On Monday, we'll be talking about a new journalism project called Black Science Matters with a focus on Black engineers. Until then, have a great weekend. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st.